Welcome to This Is Not About Your Body, a body neutrality podcast where we talk about all the real shit body image issues are actually about because they're never just about the way you look. I'm your host, Jessie Nealand, and today I have with me Sarah Yudkin, who is a relationship anxiety coach, the founder of You Love and You Learn, and the host of the You Love and You Learn podcast, where she explores the nuance and context that most modern relationship advice is missing. Sarah is passionate about helping folks feel peaceful, happy, and content in their relationship, and I am so excited to have her on here to talk about all things relationship anxiety. So welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Yeah. So I'm going to have you start by talking a little bit about the work that you do. Specifically, who do you most often work with, and what is it that you're working with them around or helping them with?
Yeah. So I would say that I have primarily worked with women in the past. I think I just resonate more with women, but it doesn't mean that men or other people in general do not experience relationship anxiety. Sure. And I would say primarily I work with people who are in longer term relationships, or they're kind of in a more serious, committed relationship. So even if maybe it's only been a few months, it still feels like a big deal. Yeah. Because it's more committed or more serious in the past. And similar to your work around, like, it's not really about your body image, it's usually about something a lot deeper. I would say that that's a lot of what happens with relationship anxiety. A lot of times I would say it's not even related to our partner, our relationships, really. It's just how we view the world, how we view ourselves. And because relationships are important to a lot of people, our inner stuff gets mirrored back to us in that way. And so what I'm trying to mostly help people understand is what are their core beliefs and fears and patterns that are blocking them from showing up more consistently or openly in their relationship, and how can they get clarity on that so that they can show up with more intentionality and maybe be a little bit more open-hearted versus feeling like there's all these walls.
Awesome. So it's so funny you say that, because that was one of my like key questions, is to be like, is it similar to the stuff I do with body neutrality? But before we get into that, I want to just get a framework, like a definition from you, if you have one, for what is relationship anxiety? What does it look like? Any examples? Just because I feel like in some ways it seems a little obvious, but I'm also sure that you have your own sort of clear definition there.
Yeah, I would say that there's different ways to experience relationship anxiety. At its very simplest, it's like you're experiencing consistent anxiety within a relationship. But I would say that based on attachment styles, that can show up differently for people. So my primary experience of it was I'm having a lot of doubt about, is this the right person? Is this the one? What if this doesn't work out? Like, am I missing any red flags? Are we compatible enough? It was kind of like this perfectionist view of trying to make sure I had all my ducks in a row. And for some background context, my parents got a divorce when I was in my young 20s. And then I met my now fiance when I was in my mid 20s. And so I would say within a few years of that separation and divorce happening, which, I mean, I would say at the time I kind of stuffed it down and I was like, okay, I get it. Like, no big deal. But I think there's still some, you know, feelings around it that I probably could have done a better job of processing. I was now about to meet someone very important to me. And so in the back of my head, it was like, hey, this doesn't always work. So you need to be sure that like you're picking the right person. So that's a lot of what my clients experience. But then there's also another type of anxiety that can show up for people, which is, does this person like me enough? Am I good enough for them? And sometimes it can be a combination of both. Like, sometimes you don't feel good enough, and so then you project it out to someone else that they're actually not good enough. So it's really different for certain people's experiences, but at its core, it's like having consistent anxiety, maybe in the form of thoughts or feelings that affect you from showing up in your relationship in the way that you want to.
What was your, out of curiosity, your attachment style, how would you sort of define or understand it, leading to that perfectionistic, make sure you pick the right person, are we compatible kind of anxiety?
Yeah. So before I started exploring more about attachment styles and what they meant, I would have labeled myself as more avoidant in that way, because when things got too serious or like too close, I felt like I was kind of putting up these walls. But now that I've actually just explored, I did a coaching certification about integrated attachment theory, understanding what attachment theory is and how it applies to like our needs and boundaries and things like that. And I would say I'm more fearful avoidant, which is actually a fun combination of both anxious and avoidant. So I think that it makes a lot of sense now that as I see it, it's like if I feel Nate, my fiance, pulling away, even if it's not actually him pulling away, it's like he has a lot of his stuff going on, or I feel disconnected, I lean in. Whereas if I feel like there's a lot of connection and maybe to the point where I don't have my space, then I sometimes pull away. So that can be a fun combination to navigate, but it makes sense like why it happens.
Totally. Okay. So I don't know if you know anything about the body image avatars from my book, but I feel like I can immediately see the relationship anxiety themes for each avatar, that like I'm imagining the self-objectifier and probably the high achiever being super focused on like, do they like me? Am I earning their love enough? Am I good enough? That kind of thing. And then the other two maybe being a bit more focused on like, are they the right one? Maybe they're not, being more critical, pushing them away, that kind of thing, which obviously I've thought about in terms of attachment, but it's interesting to think about like just the different directions of sort of where the anxiety focuses. Like it's all anxiety, but it's going to have different like language in their brains, you know?
Yeah. Different outlets for sure. And I do feel like, you know, I don't like oversimplifying things by any means, because one of the things that I talk about all the time is there's so much nuance and so much context, but I do think that like in the same way you've explored these in your book, and I'm not familiar with all the names, so you'll have to weave those in if you want to talk about those more. But I think like even when you just said like the high achiever, it's like, if anyone's familiar with internal family systems at all, it's like those inner parts of ourselves that want to come out in different ways. Like, I just feel like there are very stereotypical patterns I notice in my work. And so I try not to bucket people in any certain way, but I'm sure there's a lot of overlap in what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Okay. So the big question I think that interests me most is, and obviously this is not like a quick answer, but I'm just curious to hear thematically, like, what is it usually about? What are the underlying issues that if it's not really about what the partner not being perfect or them actually rejecting you, which I think if it were about those things, people would not usually be getting excited about a podcast topic like this, because it would just seem very logical and that would be that. I think we usually know there's something else going on, even if we can't name it. So I'm curious what you see as like, what are those underlying reasons or sources that lead to it, the anxiety?
Yeah, I would say in an umbrella term, it's about like feeling unsafe in some way. But what I mean by that is usually there's some sort of fear happening about what the relationship represents, either about like the dynamic or about us. So like if this doesn't work between us and this dynamic doesn't work, then that means I'm a failure, or I'm not good at making decisions, or if this dynamic isn't as exciting as it should be, then I'm settling, I'm not living up to my potential. And so what does it represent for you, and what are you really scared of that a relationship can contribute to? Is it like realizing that you might lose someone important to you, or is it that you might lose yourself in a relationship and like feeling like you get so enmeshed and then you don't get to live out the dreams and goals that you have? If it doesn't work out, do you deem that as it's a failure and like I messed this all up and so now my life is over, like if I don't stay with a partner, you know? Like I think a lot of people equate divorce as like that's the worst thing that could happen to me, like I don't ever want to put my kids through that. Maybe you went through it yourself as a kid. And I had to realize like a lot of the meaning that I was prescribing to a lot of these things weren't necessarily true, but I created this whole story and narrative around it, like this not working out would mean something horrible. And so we have this goal for what our life can look like, and it's a beautiful thing, usually like a vision of how things could look, but on the other side of a goal is usually the fear of the goal not being reached or something not looking like we expected. And so a lot of times our partner, even if they are an amazing partner, safe, loving, it could be a great relationship, if we have a deeper fear of divorce, of failure, of not being good enough, of, you know, not being safe in some way, of uncertainty of what the outcome will be, then all of that is going to show up because that person is the person we're in a relationship with.
Totally. So what I think is kind of funny is hearing you talk about your definition, it almost sounds like the work you do could be called, like in parallel with my work, like relationship neutrality, because it's about stripping away the meaning and significance that is false, inflated, or, you know, otherwise not quite accurate, away from the thing so that you can just see and deal with what's really in front of you. Much like being like, oh, if I've gained weight, that means I'm bad and I'm a failure and I'm lazy and everybody will hate me, I'll never find love. Like, that's a whole narrative. Whereas just the fact of like, this isn't how I would prefer to look today, can be pretty neutral, right? When that narrative is taken away, I hear you talking about the narratives that we, the meaning and significance and narratives that we apply to relationships being the source of the suffering, just like it is with body image.
For sure. And that's why I think body image or even relationships or career or, you know, finances, like it's really just about the way that we view the world and how we've grown up and the past experiences we've had and how that's shaped how we show up. And so the avenue of which I work with people is relationships. The avenue of which you're supporting people is through body image. But like, really, I would say, and I've thought about this before, this is like a sidebar, like, is relationship anxiety coach even the right way to describe what I'm supporting people with, which is more of like how to be human, you know? Yeah. But like the way that people arrive to the work I'm doing is because they have that particular flavor of challenge in their relationships, but it's really just like a microscope up to like the other things that are happening in their life and in their mind and in their body. Yeah. So I think a lot of this work in general is just about like growing and understanding yourself better, but it's hard, I feel like, just to be like, I help you live. Like, that doesn't really, you know, it's so
vague. Not a sexy marketing slogan. No, I think you're totally right. I always say, like, we start by talking about body image because that's usually where people are coming in with the most distress. But at a certain point in the process, we are not talking about body image anymore. Like, we are talking about those underlying narratives, meaning, pain points, fears, shame, you know, it's all the things. And of course, I'm sure you talk about body image and I'll talk about relationships because at a certain point, it's all the same thing.
Totally. And like what your needs are as a person, let's say, like, this is another thing where our relationships hold this like mirror back to us, where someone might be like, I'm feeling so bored in my relationship, but maybe they have this need for like a creative outlet, or they have this need for emotional connection that isn't really being met fully by their partner because one person can't be the only thing that like makes you happy. Right. So it's like, okay, I'm in this relationship and I'm noticing some patterns where like, I've been feeling more bored lately, or I've been, you know, missing some of the excitement for newness and I've been craving more novelty. It's like these things can help teach us how we think and feel about the world, but the way it's being mirrored back to us is through this other person that we spend a lot of time with. So I think even the same thing with like body image, it's like maybe someone needs more play and fun in their life, and they've just been spending so much time obsessing over their body and how it looks, and they're actually just really craving like a fun day at the beach.
Totally.
But it's felt so big and scary to even like put that bathing suit on and go. So I think some of these avenues of which we're working on ourselves, again, they're just really important to us at that time, but they are usually, I don't want to say masks, but they're just like, you know, the symptom of something that can be a little bit deeper.
I always say, like, once you pull back the curtain and you kind of see like, oh, I'm afraid of being abandoned. Like, what used to feel to me like shamey, fat, ugly, whatever the thing is, right? Like, you pull the back the curtain and you're like, oh, I'm scared, I'm sad, I'm feeling vulnerable, whatever it is, it just immediately makes the original story lose some of its power. It's not going to make those thoughts go away because that's habitual and whatever, but once you actually, you look behind and go, oh, is that really okay, and then it just sort of feels a little bit more grounding, I think, to us, because it's crazy making. Like a wild goose chase to be like in the fantasy of body image anyway, it can be like, if only I could lose this weight, I would feel amazing and nobody would ever reject me and everything would be perfect. Like, some part of you must know that is not possible, or it's whatever it is, because it feels very agitated. And when you actually look at the thing underneath, even when you can't do jack shit about it, because you're like, oh, I'm just sad, there is a release, right? There's like a, okay, well, I guess I'll just be sad then.
Totally. Yeah. That same type of thread of, if I could just lose the weight, is kind of like, if I could just feel 100% sure this is the one.
I was going to say, what's the parallel for relationships? Like, what's the fantasy people have of, if I could just what?
Yeah. Like, if I never felt anxious about this, if I felt 100% sure, you know, a phrase people love to throw around is like, I just knew my partner was the one, or when you know, and for a lot of people, their experience doesn't match that, but we have that as like some gold standard of like, well, that's just how you know. And so, or like, you know, whatever it is. So I think people have this kind of, like you said, the fantasy or the illusion that like, well, if I just had 100% certainty, then that guarantees the outcome. And one thing that's actually helped me reframe this, and I don't know if this feels true for you or not, but sometimes I think that that can actually have a negative effect for certain types of relationships where you're just like, oh yeah, I just had this confidence and certainty. And so like, because things are so good, like we don't have to nurture and foster the relationship. And so it's just like, it works, like because we work together versus, I'm not saying I want everyone to have these doubts. Like at a certain point, it's like not helpful, but a certain level of doubt or just like, oh, like how does a relationship work well? How do I pour energy into that in an intentional way can actually help you create a relationship where you're putting that effort in. It's kind of like the fixed versus growth mindset where you're like, oh, if a relationship is just good or not good, then the good ones you don't have to put energy into because it should just last forever. Whereas someone who's a little bit more growth minded might always be looking for a little way to help nurture and improve the relationship.
Oh, I love that. I also feel like, so I am good at many things, but relationships have historically been a weak point for me. It's something that I feel like just never came naturally to me. Like relationships with humans came naturally, but partnership I always found really difficult. And I am also engaged. And so this has been like the first time that I've really had to kind of contend with like an unwillingness to lose someone, which at first was like catastrophic. I think I'm getting, it's been like 4.5 years. So I'm getting more comfortable with it, but it was just like, oh my God, does this mean I literally just can't blow it up and like be an asshole? Like, oh my God, I have to learn how to be nice. I have to like, it just was so challenging. And I really do feel like in the shamier moments, that reframe would have been so helpful to be like, I'm one of the people for whom I will never settle. Like we'll never break up because things got, you know, we just took it for granted and stopped putting effort in, right? Like there is something in that that's actually like kind of a wonderful strength, even though it certainly does bring up its own issues and obstacles.
Totally. And that word you just used, settle, I know is a big trigger for a lot of my clients and something I used to worry because I think especially too on social media, I mean, social media has brought so many wonderful things. I feel like I give this disclaimer and I don't need to, but it's like there's annoying things about it. We all know there's annoying parts of it. And I think the never settle, like, you know, make sure you're living your most authentic life. And like, you know, there's a lot of great inspiration on social media, but for the anxious mind or the analytical mind where the high achiever is like, I need to like just, I can't ever like settle into anything. It's like settling at all means that you're doing something wrong. And so I think that redefining what settling looks like for certain people, if that word feels really big and scary, like trying to explore what that definition looks like for you. And I have a whole webinar on this topic, but it's like, if you feel like settling is this big bad word, what does it look like to settle into life with someone? Because eventually, have to settle down at some point if that's your goal. Like, if you want to be with one person, then in some way, like, you're going to settle into a relationship with that person versus, like, oh, I'm just, you know, I have zero expectations or I have no standards for anything. That's what I think gets like conflated. And it's a fine line between what those two things are.
Ooh, that's such an interesting one too, because I think when I just used it, I don't remember exactly how I said it, but I think I was basically meaning like more of not learning how to nurture a relationship, you know, more like settle in a passive way, like away from each other.
Complacency.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's such a lovely idea of settling into life with someone. And I totally understand because I think the settle word, as you were saying, the meaning before, like the meaning is like that you're fucked basically. If you've settled, you picked the wrong person and nothing will ever work out for you ever again. It's like a big, very pathologized word. Oh, that person's settled.
Yeah. And it's very final, like that. Yeah. Again, going back to the fixed or growth mindset, it's like you settled. So now, like, you settled forever and like, you can't do anything about it. It kind of takes away any sort of responsibility or power that you might have to like grow towards something. So we don't have to like make the whole podcast about settling, but I just think it's like that word, even to the anxious mind, there's just a deeper meaning for everything when you're coming through this filter of relationship anxiety and assessing things. So just a reminder that like even a word like that doesn't have to be necessarily what your interpretation is initially.
So another fantasy that I'm guessing is really common for you in the work that you do with people is finding the one. Like, I don't know how often you work with people who are actually single, but like when I work with single people, there is often this fixation on like, if I found the right partner, and it usually starts with, if I looked the right way, then I'd find the right partner and then I'd be happy forever. I would feel confident and secure and everything would be great. Do you ever come across that or work with people who are looking?
For sure. So, well, I would say even when you're in a relationship, the question can still be, are they the one? Like, I'm trying to make the final decision.
Oh, of course,
So I would say if I had to put a percentage on it, like primarily like 90% or more of the people I work with are in relationships. And then of the people I've worked with that are more single, it's like they are trying to get to know themselves more so that they can be in a more healthy dynamic the next time around. But I would say that it doesn't discriminate whether you're already in the relationship. People can still be very fixated on, is this the one? And that was a question I asked myself a lot too. And I think it's because we've built up the one into kind of like this perfect person. You have to be the perfect person. They have to be the perfect person. Like in your case, someone wants to lose this weight, so they're the perfect partner, so they can be perfect for this person they meet. And I would just say like, at the end of the day, it's back to that mindset of like, can you grow together? And like, is there a willingness between everyone in the relationship versus I find the one and they're kind of who they are and I'm who I am and nothing will change and evolve. I just think it's about, again, remembering that humans are fluid and like there's going to be ebbs and flows to who you are and who they are and how the relationship works.
That also makes me think of like the people who make sense. If your paradigm for the one is like everything about us is compatible and checks out and it's not about that growth mindset, like there's no way two people continue to grow perfectly parallel in tandem throughout life. Like there's no way that ends up working. And if you didn't have the skills or vision to do that work, like that, I'm just picturing, you know, like head cheerleader, head football player getting a divorce in their 30s, like that was maybe what felt on paper so perfect, so aligned. But then as they are being challenged in these other ways, like there's nothing there to maintain that.
Yeah, it's almost like you think of, I don't even know if this is the right analogy, but like the DNA type of shape, like the squiggles. I don't even know if those things, sorry, I'm like tapping my mic, if they like go in and out of each other. But if you imagine like kind of that's how, you know, people are in a relationship and there can be more than two squiggles, that's fine. But it's just like whoever's in a relationship, like there's going to be these seasons and moments where you're kind of like coming together more and then separating and like doing your own thing. And maybe at certain stages, one person needs the support more than others in the relationship. Like in, you know, one person starting a new career and like they really need extra support, and another person may have a challenge with their mental health at some point and they need support. So I think like what we're saying is about flexibility, but also knowing what you value, I think, like, and like your baseline, like if there's certain things that like, no matter what, like I really want to have kids, or no matter where we live, like it's really important to me that like we can be somewhat close to family. It's like just knowing what things feel more like a sacrifice to you versus a compromise. And that I think is sometimes easier said than done. And sometimes it happens more in the moment where you're realizing, ooh, this feels a little sticky. Like, can we come up with a solution?
Yeah. And I think that's really hard to do, especially given that like we're sort of force fed from childhood on like one particular image of what we're supposed to want and like and be attracted to and find romantic and find ideal and all this stuff. So it's like a lifetime's worth of work to even figure out what your, you know, non-negotiables really are, to unlearn what was sort of planted in your head and be like, actually, I can compromise on all those things are okay. But here's this totally other thing that I can't live without. That takes so much work and time to get to know that about yourself. And I feel like the pressure to, you know, find a relationship that's permanent in your 20s certainly does not align with that timeline very well for a lot of folks.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's interesting because I met Nate when we were like 24 and 25, and I never felt that pressure to like find the one, but it just like, I really obviously like loved him and we wanted to be together. So it's worked out and that we're now like in 7+ years together, engaged and all of that. But in my most anxious moments, there would be stories that I would hear where like celebrities met their person when they were in their mid to late 30s and they were fully formed and all these things. And it was oh man, I should have waited. And then it's like, there's so many circumstances and it's like, it's kind of just about like whatever works. But I agree that like all these pressures are so hard and it takes time to get to know yourself. Yeah. And I think there's even things that we've been conditioned are like hard and fast deal breakers that I don't know, like this is going to be taboo and like most people might not agree, but Esther Perel with her book, A State of Affairs, for example, like understanding sometimes that the affair is not this personal thing that people make it to be, like, you don't love me and you don't care about me. Who is it that I was just listening to? Dan Savage was doing a podcast. He has a big podcast and he was doing 10% Happier episode. And he said something like, monogamy is one of the only things that like we give people either an 100% score or a 0% score versus like you're in a 50-year relationship and one thing happened and like you would actually still be like very, very monogamous over the long term, but people are very like all or nothing. Like that's a hard and fast deal breaker. So I'm not saying, and I don't have experience with this, so it's easy for me to have an opinion until it's happened to you. But I think that's a very common thing in the culture where it's like, oh my gosh, like I could never stay with someone like that. It's very demonized versus like, how can we try and understand what was happening here? And like try to potentially see if like there's something that we can learn from this. And if not, and if someone's like, all right, like I did this maliciously, I don't care about you. But again, like I'm just saying there's certain things in the culture that are like what you said, conditioned into us. And so it's really hard to actually feel empowered to explore if that feels true for us or not.
Absolutely. And I would say that the one you named is such a stigmatized one too, that like, so I love Esther Perel. I'm non-monogamous, so that's like very much my world. Obviously you can cheat on someone even inside of non-monogamy because it's about breaking the relationship agreements. Everyone has agreements, whatever they might be. So I fully understand that it could happen. Although I think in non-monogamy, you tend to have been a little more thoughtful generally for each individual, kind of considering like what would allow this to feel spacious, whereas monogamy often is just a default. Like a lot of people, unfortunately, don't think about if that really suits them. But it's stigmatized because I feel like especially for women, and obviously this totally depends, right? Like if you're in a super religious culture, then divorcing him is probably more shameful than staying. But in a lot of progressive spaces and circles, clients I've worked with, they're like, at this point, because he cheated, if I stay, my whole community will see me as this like weak pushover of a woman who like lets my husband cheat on me and stays. It would be pathetic. You know, it's got this massive stigma almost on both sides, really. But
totally.
But yeah, how do you even figure out for yourself, like, is that or is that not a deal breaker with all of that massive messaging coming your way?
Yeah, it would be, I mean, I can't speak from experience on this one. So it would definitely be hard. I think like that would be a very prime example of like having external support, like mentorship or like, you know, counseling and making sure that again, both parties or whoever's involved are willing and able to like come to the table and be open about it. Because again, if it's like, okay, well, you cheated and you have no remorse, it's like, all right, well, then that shows more of like who you are as a person versus like, oh my gosh, like I completely lost myself. I had all this resentment building up and I never shared that, but I'm fully taking ownership. And like, this was like acting out in a way to try and get attention. And like, I would never even dream of doing it. I don't know. It's like, again, you can't make necessarily.
You're literally talking about though, like if the person is capable of doing the introspective work, the healing, the communicating and transparency, the rebuilding of the trust. Like it absolutely is possible under those circumstances. And I feel like I've worked with quite a few clients who have dealt with infidelity in different partnerships. And it never once ever have I seen someone decide to leave in the end because of the actual infidelity. It was always because of how the partner showed up after.
Totally.
Refusing to take accountability, refusing to do the repair work, perhaps incapable of doing the introspective, you know, kind of healing work necessary. And that's where the call gets made. Like, we can't do this together. I can't go through this with you.
Totally. Yeah. Another example of like it not really being about the thing.
Yeah, totally.
Like something else.
Oh, that's so true. Okay. So I'm curious because I feel like this is very much an attachment style thing, but like the anxious leaning in, like wanting connection and reassurance, wanting a lot of validation or feeling like, you know, the slightest, whatever thing can happen, a word, a look, a gesture, an action. And for some people, that's going to immediately make them be like, this relationship is over. They don't love me anymore. They hate me. They don't desire me. Like everything's crumbling. And I feel like in my mind anyway, on the other side is irritation or criticalness. But I'm curious if you see these as like opposites or if there's another version of this in the avoidant space, because I know I veer towards that. I veer towards annoyed, cold, like all of the things. I would never want anyone to treat me this way. And I hate that I do it, but it definitely is like of the two, it's where I find myself historically. Yeah.
So how I think of it is that underneath most of the attachment styles is a form of anxiety, and that certain styles, when they feel that anxiety, are more likely to activate into the situation, try to get that reassurance, reconnect. Yeah. Whereas other people, their response to the anxious feelings is to deactivate. So I would say the underneath the surface, there's still a lot of discomfort. Something's coming up. Maybe it could be irritation. Like some sort of fear usually is like really what's underneath the surface, or some sort of discomfort, not feeling fully safe and comfortable. But then the method of taking action or a next step is different. So I don't know if that fully answered your question, but I try not to look at the styles as, even though they are very different in certain ways, they actually have a lot more in common than we probably realize, which is just like there's some sort of insecurity going on underneath it, and the way that the insecurity manifests can be different.
Yeah, so maybe opposites isn't a helpful framework there. But I guess part of what I wonder is when I talk to people who have more of that like anxious seeking of reassurance and validation, it seems to live in their heads. Like there's so much thinking happening. And at least for me, and certainly some other people that I've connected with who kind of veer in this direction, I don't ever think to myself pretty much anything other than like, ugh, like this is so annoying or whatever. I don't have the story to accompany it, which is part of a lot of the work I've done in my life to move away from stories in that way. But it also, I feel like, leaves me unable to do anything. Cause at least even though if you're spiraling mentally, you kind of, you can address that story. And I'm like, there is no story. I just feel like throwing something. What do you do with that?
Yeah. Well, in some ways that can actually be a blessing, because that means you're probably tapped into more of the feeling versus the story and the thinking. And then I would say it is more about just like being with that feeling, you know, like how we were talking about earlier. It's like, you don't always have to like do something about it. Sometimes you just need to maybe like be angry or like be upset and like move through it. So I think that that could actually be a good thing in some ways, which is like, I feel angry. Okay. I need to take some space and like, you know, listen to angry music on my walk and, you know, growl to myself or whatever it is, or I need to like go to my boxing class, like whatever it is. Or I can express like without a negative story on top, like, hey, I'm feeling frustrated and I can't really put my finger on why, but I just need some me time or whatever it is. So I don't think that enough people actually are willing to tap into the feeling underneath the anxious thinking.
And that's why I think in some ways it comes from the work I've done. Like I learned to be in touch with the embodied experience. And I know for me, a lot of anxiety for me in my previous life with body image issues, a lot of times it was like, I was anxious first, that just lived in me. And then my brain went, let's come up with a story to tell about this. Like, let's give this context. It was almost random. And I mean, it obviously wasn't random. There were other factors, but it could have been anything. You know, if we lived in a society where there was other socially acceptable things to freak out about, I would have freaked out about those things. And I feel sometimes like there is a similarity with relationships that, like, whatever was there in my body probably would have been there no matter what, but my partner just happens to live here. So it's like my brain goes, you know, and it's probably his fault. And even though the story isn't necessarily that compelling, it gets associated in that way.
For sure. Yeah. There's this book that I really enjoyed. It's very like matter of fact, practical, called The Relationship Handbook by George Pransky. And he talks a lot about this, about how incompatibility is kind of subjective. Like it's not necessarily always that you're incompatible, but if you're in a not so great mood, that thing about your partner is like always going to piss you off. But if you're more connected to that person, then you're like, oh, like that's that weird quirk that they have or whatever.
Totally.
So sometimes like incompatibility is actually very complimentary, but like your mood is just not in the right space. So like if I'm just having like today, I just got some like random email about like taxes that I wasn't expecting. Yeah. And I just felt dysregulated from that. And so, I mean, I didn't necessarily take it out on Nate today, but like there have been times where I probably would have just been like, ugh, like I can't, I need my own time, or like I'm feeling overwhelmed. And then something later in the day might have really irritated me. Whereas like if I'm just having a great day, I just got off a great podcast interview and I'm like, oh, that was so fun, I might like go into the other room and just be like, hey babe, so great to see you. So I'm not saying that all of it is internal. Yeah. Like there are very real dynamics between people that can affect relationships. So it's not about blaming ourselves, but it's just about checking in. And like you said, if there's some unsettled energy already within me, I don't need to always explain that.
Right. It almost, I kind of really like about that, the idea that the incompatibility can be your mood is what's incompatible with them in that moment or whatever. Like that is not, again, a diagnosis for life or a death sentence for the relationship, to be like, yeah, we are incompatible because right now I'm mad and you're not. Like, that's all sometimes.
Totally. Like, I mean, people have different beliefs on this as well. This could be like a topic that not everyone agrees with me, but I think that like, if you have slightly different political beliefs, like that's not as black or white as people make it out to be, especially I think like during election season, it's like, my gosh, like this is the worst person ever because they think this. There's certain things where it's like, okay, I want you to respect like basic things. But if we have different opinions about certain things and you are riled up after just watching something on the news, it's going to feel like a big incompatibility versus if you're like having this cozied moment and you're like, oh, I'm curious, like, what do you think about this thing? And you're coming at it from more of an open-hearted place. So there's certain boundaries people have around religion, politics, like cultural differences, but a lot of those things, again, can be very dependent on how you're feeling and showing up. So it's not black and white.
I love that. So tell me about this open-hearted place. And it sounds like if we all were there more often, our relationships would all be thriving. How do we get there? How do we stay there?
Oh my gosh, I wish it was a permanent state, but I think
so do I.
I wish it was like a literal destination that you could drive to and be like, oh, I'm at the open-hearted state now. Yeah. It's like the 51st state of the United States.
I would move there. I would.
But at the end of the day, so there's this great quote, and I'm going to butcher it, but it's this Rumi quote that's like, your task is not to seek for love, but to seek to remove the barriers from love, or something like that. So my belief is that in our core or soul or whatever people think, like just who we are as humans, like we have so much love within us, but when we're showing up from a place of fear, or when there's walls up in our relationship or whatever showing up in our life, if we're feeling overwhelmed, that's kind of stacking on top of the love that we have. And so, yes, there are things we can do to become more open-hearted that are more like, okay, like I'm going to do something nice, or, you know, I'm going to, you know, have a moment of me time and reconnect to myself. But I think a lot of it is about being aware of like, what's blocking me from showing up in a loving place right now? Do I have a lot of pressure that I'm putting on the situation? Am I expecting this to go a certain way? Like, you know, if we're at date night and we're not having like the most interesting conversation, am I really beating myself up for that? You know, like, is there a lot of weight being put on something? Am I under timeline stress? Like, I need to know if this person is the one in 6 months. Like, yeah. You know, like, what are the things, like, are there judgments showing up towards yourself or towards this other person? Like, so it's not always so clear, but when we slow down and create more of a curious relationship with ourselves and like start seeing patterns, a lot of times we can see that there's certain things that make us feel like our heart is closed or these walls are coming up. And yeah. So it's not easy and it's not overnight, but it's about noticing what patterns show up most and then trying to slowly take steps towards, you know, removing those blocks. But I will say, like, you know, we joked about it, that we would move to the state of open-hearted, but like, it is an ebb and a flow. So like, there will be moments of connection and disconnection. There will be irritations, but also times where you feel lovey and excited. Like Nate and I call it a love bubble. Like sometimes the love bubble is popped, but other times we're in it and like, yeah, we have that, you know, energy. So I think it's not about a permanent state of open-heartedness. It's about realizing that with lightness comes dark and darkness comes light. And like, there has to be both in order for it to feel like you have anything else. Like, you can't feel connected without disconnection, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And the more pressure you put on yourself to be in open-hearted land, the less likely you're going to get there. Kind of like orgasm, like the yep. pressure is going to be the block.
For sure. Yep. That's a really good point, is like, if you're trying to be connected, like that's kind of missing the point a little bit. And I find like yeah. the less I try, the more it happens.
Totally. So Drew, my partner, and I have a million tools to bring me back to a place of compassion when that has evaporated into thin air. And literally I can just like watch an episode of a show with like a shitty guy. And then I'll be like, God, Drew. And he'll be like, I didn't do that. Like, that was not about me. And I have to really, like, we have all these tools to bring back like, oh, right. You're right. You're just like a regular whole person with feelings and I love you. And it brings the compassion back. And there's so many ways of doing it, but not a single one of them is telling me to be compassionate or me trying to feel connected.
Totally. Or shaming yourself, like, oh yeah, exactly. I can't believe I was like being such a bitch or whatever in that moment. It's like, oh, that never
does
has
not
worked.
Help.
Nope. Exactly. And it makes me like, when I feel guilty, that's one thing I would say if anyone has experienced relationship anxiety, and I'm sure same with body image mm-hmm. stuff, it's like the more time you spend stuck in like, like I fucked that up, or like I messed yeah. up and I wish that I hadn't done that, or I wish I never thought like this, I wish yeah. I, you know, didn't have to go through this, then you're going backwards, or best case, you're circling around in the same exactly. spot. And it's just another sneaky way of resistance blocking you from moving forward, which I yeah. totally understand. And it's not easy, but like, it's something we have to like create a more loving relationship with. It's like, oh, there's my pattern. It's not me choosing to do this. This is like yeah. my conditioning and how I've learned to show up, but like I can choose the next step here.
Yeah. In fact, that's it's one of the reasons I even have in the book, like first or second chapter is like, I know this sounds counterintuitive and weird as a body image coach, but you have to give yourself permission to hate your body today. You have to. It has to start with a willingness to say that whatever misery you're in today is okay, because you can't, if you're blocking that, you can't get to the next step and the next step. Like, it really does have to be like, yeah, I hate how I look in this moment, and that makes sense.
Yep.
Given
yep.
all of the factors, that makes sense and is okay for today. I can accept that. Now there's like real work to be done, you know?
Exactly. It's kind of like arguing with reality. I feel like that's an expression exactly. expression people yeah. say all the time, but it's like, don't argue one. With reality, like just allow it to be. And like in this moment, yeah. oh, like I'm not as attracted to my partner. Like, oh, that people feel so shamey even right. saying that to me. Like, I can't believe I just said that on a coaching call. And it's like, oh, but like, what if that was okay? Like, what if it made sense yeah. that like, you won't be attracted to your partner all the time, but then comes all these beliefs of like, well, you should only have eyes for your partner and you should uh-huh. feel attracted to them. So then it becomes about, okay, like, what if maybe it wasn't wrong and it was just about yeah. changing the way you relate to this experience. So I'm totally on board with that.
Okay. So that was actually one of the questions I really wanted to get to. So thank you for that. Perfect little bridge. I wrote down attraction anxiety. I don't know if you call it that, but I work work with so many people who have both directions. So a lot of time it'll be like, I've been with my partner for 2 years and all of a sudden out of nowhere, my attraction is gone. My libido is gone. That kind of thing causes so much distress and anxiety. Sometimes it was never there. Sometimes it was a slow burn. And in sort of the other direction, it's like if their partner stops wanting to have sex as much or whatever, the anxiety about them not being as desirable or attractive. So I want to hear what is going on with this. What is your thoughts? And yeah, anything you want to share about that?
Yeah. Well, attraction. Oh my gosh, such a vast topic. So I feel like we could take it in a lot of places, but yeah. I'll share some thoughts and you respond of what resonates with you. But I do think that attraction is one of those conditioned things that we really have put on a pedestal where it's like, I have this type. And like, unless I'm with this type, then like, I won't be able to be attracted. It's like, we're waiting for an external thing to create our output. Like if my partner looks hot today, then I get to feel turned on type thing. So I think sometimes we're placing a lot of responsibility on our partner to make us feel internally turned on and ready to rumble. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm saying that like, it doesn't matter at all. Like, I do think there's something about being drawn towards a person or like, you know, wanting to be around a person sometimes, not 24/7, but like this thing of like, oh yeah, like I wanted to be getting to know you. Like, I'm curious about you. Like, there's something about you that I am drawn to that can be relevant, but expecting it to be there all the time and expecting it to be a permanent thing can be where it trips people up, I think, because I'm 7 years in to my relationship. And like, there are moments where we just feel like, you know, sitting on the couch in our sweatpants and like, I'm not feeling very attracted to myself in that moment.
Right,
I'm certainly not feeling attracted to Nate as much. Yeah. Whereas like when we're out and about and in a new city, like we just went on a weekend trip and had a great time. And I felt like we were both kind of in our best energy. So I do think there's more to it than just I'm not attracted to you right now. I think it can be like, how are you feeling about yourself? Like, are you still putting in the energy and effort towards things the way you used to be? Are you infusing fun and lightness and play? Like, are you doing new things together? It's not as simple as just like, oh, I fell out of love or I'm not attracted to you anymore. I think it's about like sustaining that attraction.
Totally. I think there are so many harmful myths in this space. One being like men are visual, which could be true, whatever the sort of research is out on that. But like the way it gets interpreted is men are exclusively visual and there's nothing else ever going on for them. So if they don't feel like having sex right now, then they think you're ugly. Like it gets turned into this whole other thing and sits on the background of if they're not attracted to you, since that's basically what they value women for, then he doesn't love you and he's going to leave you.
Yeah.
So God, does it get messy quickly.
Yeah.
But I feel like the one that you mentioned being so shamey is I'm not attracted to my partner right now. And I honestly think they both create a lot of distress depending on the situation. But I think that one is shamier because we don't talk about it as much. Because you can say to any of your friends, like, I'm afraid he's not attracted to me anymore. And everyone will go, oof, I understand that thought. But to say, I don't know if I'm attracted to him anymore or them anymore, a lot of people will be like,
yeah, exactly. Like, is something wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Like maybe this relationship is over. It like has this really secretive kind of quality.
Totally. Well, I think if you've said that same thing, like, I don't know if I love them anymore or if I'm in love with them anymore, it's the same reaction. And I'm not here to say that like there's never an expiration date on a relationship. Sure. Like, I'm not here to say everyone should just stay together forever. And like, that's not even true. But at the same time, this idea of in love, I also think gets put on this pedestal of like infatuation, chemistry, spark, all these things, when it's like a lot of this is like you have to fan the flame, like you have to keep showing up for it. And chemically in our body, like there are just different chemicals happening at the beginning when there's this newness and excitement. Right. And for some people that can be 6 months, for some people that's 6 weeks, for some people that's 6 days, like for some people that's 6 years and they still feel this newness and excitement. But that's not necessarily dependent on the relationship. It's like how you're thinking and feeling about the relationship that mm-hmm. often affects if you're still feeling that newness and excitement. So I agree, a lot of this feels stigmatized to talk about. And that's why I try to talk about these things more openly, yeah. because a lot of people, I'm sure, are thinking it, but they're just not willing to admit it. And then it creates more shame and silence. Yeah, like, totally. And then I've heard so many conversations with clients where I'm like, I just talked about that with someone like an hour ago. I wish you were able to talk to them about it, you know? So that's why I do always group think stuff. That.
I'm like, God, I wish my clients could all just hang out in a room together and be like, oh, totally. We're not alone.
I know.
So a big thing that we will sometimes do in this space is reconceptualizing from attraction to desire.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that these words, like the actual words doesn't really matter, but most of us have an association with the word attracted, with attractive, you know what I'm saying? Like it means it has an assessment term, like they meet a conventional norm or ideal close enough anyway, in order to count as attractive. Therefore, if you are attracted, you're sort of, your headspace is, they fit those norms. It's sort of visually based, and therefore I'm allowed to feel this feeling. And to say I desire someone, we can totally take out of that context. And it's like, you could desire someone because they smell good, or because they were playing with your kids and you were like, that is hot. Or like, you know what I mean? Like, there's so many other things that, even though they kind of could totally be used interchangeably, I feel like that association with like conventionally attractive just fucks with our heads a little bit.
Totally. Yeah.
And makes us forget that there's all these other things going on that make you desire someone.
Yeah. And as cheesy as it sounds, like attraction and that word is like, I feel like it's all about the physical, and it's like, okay, you know, it's not just about the physical. It's about what's inside, right. Whatever. It's like, that's like also sometimes annoying to say, but it's like, that's why I use that word, like drawn to, like desire. Yeah. It's like whatever word resonates with someone, it's just about like, what are the things that like make you be like, yeah, this is a rad person that like I enjoy. Yeah. And like, maybe not again, 24/7, I'm like always obsessed with them, but like, there's all these things that make me keep revisiting this relationship and wanting to pour mm-hmm. into it.
Okay, so before we wrap up here, I wanted to ask, I know you have three courses. Is it anxiety or is it blank? And they're what? Intuition, incompatibility. Yeah. What's the other one?
Yeah, so those are three webinars that I have. They're just like 90-minute webinars that I have run based on like really common questions I get asked. So the first one that over 1,000 people have watched around the world, is it anxiety or incompatibility? So that's, you know, a little bit of what we talked about, like some of those, are these things deal breakers? Is this something I can actually live with? That's kind of what that addresses. Is it anxiety or intuition is kind of helping you discern, like, are these signals coming from fear? Are they coming from a place of clarity? And then the one I mentioned a little bit earlier, is it anxiety or am I settling? So helping you define what does settling mean? And like, what would it look like to intentionally build a relationship with somebody?
Yeah. What I love about them, I think, as I was sort of exploring your website, is I could like hear my clients' voices asking these questions. Like, I am working real hard to get embodied and trust myself, but I can't tell which one this is, you know? Totally. And I was like, I love that you made this just so specifically to speak to that question.
Yeah, those were, I mean, they were just questions I used to ask myself all the time, as well as I kept getting questions about like, you know, another way to say incompatibility is like, is this a red flag or not? You know, so it's just these types of questions we see touted on social media all the time of like 7 signs, like you're not in the right relationship. And people are like, oh my gosh, like, does this mean this and that? So just helping you try to trust yourself a little bit more and come from a place of like, I've thought about this intentionally. Yeah. And then yes, noise might still affect you. It's not like you're never going to compare again, but making sure the advice feels good to you and like you are setting the tone versus 1,000 different opinions coming into you and feeling like it's hard to listen to. Because for example, even with monogamy, for example, there's probably people that are like, monogamy is the way. And then there's a lot of people that are like, ethical non-monogamy is way better. Yeah. So it's like, if you're only taking external advice about that, it's going to be really hard to know because there's no such thing as better. It's just what works for you. And it's the same thing with like every other piece of advice. There's going to be multiple opinions. So you have to have a stronger sense of self-trust.
Ooh. So I feel like we could sum up both of our businesses by saying there is no right answer.
Exactly.
To any of your questions.
Exactly.
Because I think that's so true. Like, there's always nuance. There's always context. The idea that like, being polyamorous or monogamous could be better for one person with another specific partner at a certain time in their life during, you know, it's like there's so much context that makes that even make sense. You really just can't make a sentence out of it otherwise.
Totally. And that's why it can be very empowering, but also sometimes overwhelming to like decide things. And I think that's what a lot of this comes down to, is like making decisions and being grounded in them, but knowing that you don't have to be in the same decision permanently and it can evolve and change over time.
I love that. Okay. So in your opinion, what is the key, now that I've basically said that there is no easy answers here, what is the key to fulfilling and happy relationships for most people?
I want to sit with that for a second, because like we said, there is no key, but like, I want to see if I can try and sum it up. I would say a willingness. Like, that word resonates a lot, but I'll expand on it. It's not just a willingness to like make it work with somebody and like keep trying, but like a willingness to grow, a willingness to explore what it means to you to be happy and content. Like, it's kind of like, am I open to making this what it can become versus what everyone is telling me it has to be? And so the reason why the word willingness is coming up is just because it involves some level of curiosity, flexibility, like just this notion of, okay, like I'm going to keep showing up for myself and for this other person versus the rule book that we've kind of been handed down from rom-coms and the movies.
What I love about that, because I think we as a culture have an idea that willingness, at least in the way of commitment, it's like you keep trying. We've all got that down. We get that that's a part of it in terms of marriage advice and all those kinds of things. Like, you just never give up. But I think that that is so often according to the book and the rules and not at all including any of that introspective, courageous self-awareness or self-trust work. And there's only so far that that can take you. I mean, if it can take some people all the way, but like it's pretty limiting. The middle is going to be very hard, I think, for most people if they don't have that connection to themselves and that curiosity and compassion and all
that. It's like willing to continue exploring yourself, willingness to continue exploring. And then, I mean, I don't even talk about this that much just because it hasn't been my experience. I've had relationships and before, but like, it's just not my work where there's breakup coaches, but I'm not necessarily, hey, you should, you know, break up. I'm not saying, hey, stay together either. I'm just saying, here's what's happening in my experience. But a willingness could also mean a willingness to see that there's no longer willingness happening, right? So it's not about, like you said, taking it to the finish line. Sometimes the finish line can be shorter than you expected it to be, but like not making that a personal failure, and like willingness to keep trying and whatever it is. So it's just like
there's that, like, word, a self-commitment there.
Exactly.
As opposed to just sort of like a blind commitment to bang your head against a wall until the end of time, because that's what you're supposed to do.
Totally. Yeah.
All right, Sarah, tell everybody where they can find you, if they want to work with you, if they want to learn more. Where do you live on the internet?
Yep. So on Instagram, You Love and You Learn. And then, like you mentioned earlier, the You Love and You Learn podcast, which I've been having a lot of fun doing. And so Instagram is really where you can kind of find all of my offerings. And I have private coaching, group coaching, and some more digital type products. And last thing I'll say is I do have a Patreon, which is newer, just a couple months old. So if you want to hang out with other people who are going through this type of stuff and ask questions and be in that space, I have that too.
Sweet. I do too. I should talk about that more on here. That's smart. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. I feel like this is going to be one of those topics that, like, so many people can relate to, and so many people coming in from totally different backgrounds and experiences will find something in this episode. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing all of your wisdom.
Yeah, I think so too. Thank you so much.
And to all my listeners, thank you for listening. You can always reach out to me on Instagram or go to my website, jessienealon.com. We will be including that in the links in the bio, as well as links to Sarah's website and all of the other things that she mentioned. So thank you for being here, and I'll catch you next week. Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Nealand and I want to take a moment to thank you for listening to this episode of the This Is Not About Your Body podcast. I put out new episodes every Tuesday, so be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss it. And if you really enjoyed it, please go ahead and leave me a review. Also, if you're looking for more information about body neutrality or you want to work with me, you can find me at my website, jessenealand.com. Or you can just purchase my book, Body Neutral, A Revolutionary Guide to Overcoming Body Image Issues, wherever you buy books, ebooks, or audiobooks. We can also connect on Instagram or TikTok. My handle is Jesse Nealand. And because I make this podcast available for free and without any sponsors or ads, you can also feel free to show your support using the Patreon link in the show notes. And know that your support, if you decide to participate, is always very much appreciated. Lastly, thank you to my brother, Jason Nealand, for creating the music that plays at the beginning of the show. And thank you for listening, learning, and moving toward personal and collective body liberation.